Naguna
Guna Doshartha Niyamas Tadbhidam Eva Bhadate Kvachit Guna Pidosha Syad Dosho Pi Vidinaguna Guna Doshartha Niyamas Tadbhidham Eva Bhadate Kvachit Guna Pidosha Syad Dosho Pi Vidinaguna Guna Doshartha Niyamas Tadbhidham Eva Bhadate
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada's disciples. Translation. Sometimes piety becomes sin, and sometimes what is ordinarily sin becomes piety on the strength of Vedic injunctions. Such special rules, in effect, eradicate the clear distinction between piety and sin. Purport. The Lord clearly explains here that material piety and sin are always relative considerations. For example, if a neighbor's house is on fire and one chops a hole in the roof so that the trapped family may escape, one is considered to be a pious hero because of the dangerous condition. In normal conditions, however, if one chops a hole in his neighbor's roof or breaks the neighbor's windows, he is considered a criminal. Similarly, one who abandons one's wife and children is certainly irresponsible and thoughtless. If one takes sannyas, however, and remains fixed on a higher spiritual platform, he is considered to be a most saintly person. Piety and sin, therefore, depend upon particular circumstances and are at times difficult to distinguish. According to Srila Madhvacharya, a person's above the age of 14 are considered capable of distinguishing between good and bad, and are thus responsible for their pious and sinful activities. Animals, on the other hand, being merged in ignorance, cannot be blamed for their offenses or praised for their so-called good qualities, which all arise ultimately from ignorance. Human beings who act like animals, with the idea that one should not feel any guilt, but should do whatever one likes, will certainly take birth as animals absorbed in ignorance. And there are other foolish people who, observing the relativity of material piety and sin, conclude that there is no absolute good. It should be understood, however, that Krishna consciousness is absolutely good, because it involves complete obedience to the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose goodness is eternal and absolute. Those who are inclined to study material piety and sin ultimately experience frustration due to the relativity and variability of the subject matter. One should therefore come to the transcendental platform of Krishna consciousness, which is valid and perfect in all circumstances. Om jnanati mirantasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha kvachit gunaupi doshasya doshopi vidina gunaha guna doshartha niyamas tadbhidam eva badhate. Sometimes piety becomes sin, and sometimes what is ordinarily sin becomes piety on the strength of Vedic injunctions. Such special rules, in effect, eradicate the clear distinction between piety and sin. The theme of this chapter is piety and sin, and now we're hearing that there's no clear distinction between them because of Vidina. So according to Vidina, by Vidhi, or Vedic injunctions, sometimes something, the same activity can be sinful or pious according to the context. So we use the words, of course, piety and sin. Guna means piety, or good. Guna, of course, means quality. But it's often used in many places, it's used to mean good qualities. Guna means good qualities generally, even though we know it just means qualities also. But especially when it's paired with dosha, it means good qualities and bad qualities, or pious and impious, or good and bad. So guna, dosha, positive attributes and faults. So this idea of what is good, it's a philosophical question. There's a famous dialogue in Socrates. I just came across this preparing for this class, trying to look up something about this idea of the good. How do we know what is the good? So it's called the Euthyphro dilemma. Euthyphro. Das. No, not das. Euthyphro dilemma. So what it's about, Socrates was getting ready to have his preliminary hearing for his trial that was coming up. He was waiting outside the court. And there was a gentleman there. His name was Euthyphro. He was also waiting for his court appearance. So they started a discussion. Socrates asked him what he was there for. And Euthyphro explained that he was there because he was going to try to bring a charge against his own father for killing someone because someone had killed one of his servants. So this Euthyphro's father had taken this man who killed one of his servants and thrown him in a ditch and then just left him there while he went to ask authorities what was the right thing to do. He just left this guy in a ditch to die. So Euthyphro was coming to the court to bring a charge against his own father. So Socrates said, well, you must know a lot about what's right, what is morally right, that you think you can. Because generally, you can only bring a charge if the person is related to you. If the injured party is related to you, then you can bring a charge. So you're thinking that you can bring a charge, even though that's not the situation this time. So they get into discussion of how one understands what is morally right or what is good, what is pious. Actually, the Greek word is pious. I don't know what it is, but the Greek word is pious. So in the course of the conversation, now you know Socrates, in case you don't know, that everything that Socrates says is written by Plato. Plato was a student of Socrates, and he took conversations that Socrates had to bring out different philosophical points, and he wrote them. So in this particular Socratic dialogue, this question is coming up, this dilemma. So Socrates asks this Euthyphro at some point about how do you know what is pious or what is good? How do we know what is good? So he gives different answers. God kind of goes back and forth, and Socrates challenges his answers. So the conclusion of the whole thing is this essential dilemma arises. Is something good or pious because the gods, now of course in this dialogue it's the gods, but now it's become transformed into God. Is something good because God says it's good? Or because it's good, does God say it's good? In other words, what's the order here? Is it another? So this raises a dilemma. Each one of these has a problem, at least according to modern philosophers. The Christians think they have it figured out, but so I'll get to that. So what's the problem with them? The first problem is, if something is good just because God says it's good, then that seems really arbitrary, doesn't it? He could say that murder and killing children and all kinds of horrible things are good, just because I say so. Which we might think sometimes here, it says vidina, according to Vedic injunctions, something is good. What are Vedic injunctions? They're the words of God, right? So if Krishna says it's good, then it must be good. Now, of course, we have a lot of nuances to these kinds of things. Because we say, well, something is good, just like this verse says, according to circumstances, may not always be good. So we're talking about kind of general things, just like that kind of thing. You think, well, it's really arbitrary. Could God really say that murder is good? And it would be good just because God said so? Sometimes different examples are given to show the absurdity of this. For example, parents may say to a child, before you cross the street, look both ways. So is looking both ways good because the parents tell the child to do it? No, it's good, and that's why they're telling the child to do it, because it's good, safe, the right thing to do. So then there's this other part of it. So that's the problem with the first one. If God just says what's good, just according, because this was the first thing that Euthyphro said when Socrates asked him, how do we know what's good? And he says it's what the gods like. What the gods like, that's what's good. So Socrates challenged that. So this is one of his arguments. Well, what if they like something that we think is clearly not good? So then the other side of it is are things just good? And then God prescribes those things. So, for example, treating other people nicely, not harming, ahimsa, for example. Is ahimsa just good independent of God? So that's the problem with this one. It seems like it's independent of God. You have this objective reality that exists separately from God. And then he just says, look, over here is this thing or these things that are good, and you should do those things. So this is what is set up as the Euthyphro dilemma, which has been debated since Socrates' time. How do you solve? They call them the two horns of the dilemma. And the philosophers will... No, what do philosophers do? They argue back and forth, and they have all kinds of nuances and this and that. So they say, if you pick this one horn, then you're going to be gorged by the other one. If you pick the other one, you're going to be gorged by this one. So the Christians, or the theistic persons, they say there's no dilemma. This is a false dilemma. Because of God's nature, the simple fact is that God and goodness goodness is innate to God's nature. So it's not like it's a separate thing, goodness. But God is goodness in a sense, or God is good. And naturally, he's inclined to goodness. So that's what he prescribed. So this kind of sounds like something we would say. We would say, well, or God is absolutely good. Of course, this is one of the arguments that's made. I think Aquinas or Augustine made this argument, that God is absolutely good. So there's no question of him. For example, he doesn't have to choose or look elsewhere. Everything he does is good. Now, this is a point, of course, that we also make, that Krishna can't, by definition, he himself, at least, cannot do something bad. And we see simple displays of this, for example, things that may seem bad or wrong, morally wrong, they're not wrong for God. Now, also what enters into this discussion is intention, of course. What is your intention when you're doing something? So because Krishna's intention is always love, he's always driven by love, absolutely pure love, then he can't be criticized for anything. And also the outcome of what he does is always good. Just like if Krishna steals, so some people object to that. No, God is always good, so how can he steal? Because stealing is bad. Well, stealing is not necessarily always bad. There may be situations where stealing is good. And of course, when Krishna steals, it's good. It's the highest good. It's ecstatically good when Krishna steals, because so many people become pleased by that. And their attachment to Krishna increases, and their love for Krishna increases, and they laugh in great ecstasy at Krishna's exploits. So it's good. So for Krishna, lying and stealing and pinching babies and making them cry and all the nonsense things that Krishna does, which ordinarily would say bad. If another little kid did it, you might put him in the corner or something to give him a time out. But if Krishna does it, people pretend that it's bad, but of course they enjoy it like anything. But that's because Krishna is all good. He can't do anything that's not good. And even things that sometimes, other things, for example, like this creation, for example. You know this idea, the problem of evil. So why would God create this place? It's evil, or it's bad. It's bad, obviously it's bad. Look at the horrible things that happen, all the injustices. There seem to be so many injustices. Innocent people are suffering like anything. But there's one verse in the first canto that talks about Krishna's different qualities. And in the context of Krishna's creating this world, he's called Amoghalila. That means the creation is also Amoghalila. Amogha means spotless. There's no impurities. There's nothing bad. And even in something that seems bad, like Krishna's creating this material world, even that's not bad. So Krishna is always good, absolutely good. So this word came up in the purport today. The absolute truth, the supreme personality of God, whose goodness is eternal and absolute. I think I wrote about this recently. I don't know if it's come out. This idea of absolute, what does it mean, really? It's one of these words we throw around. If I were to ask you to define absolute, what would you be able to answer? What does it mean, absolute? Well, you can do it in a relative way and say not relative. In that way, you can say, well, it means not, it's the opposite of relative. Something that is absolute is not relative. But one meaning of absolute is that it doesn't depend on anything else. So it doesn't depend on anything else for its definition or for its power, you can also say. But just like Krishna's goodness doesn't depend on some concept of badness, of non-goodness. Because it's absolutely good, whatever Krishna does is by definition good. That's one idea of absolute. Now we also, of course, refer to the absolute world where everything is one, in a sense, which is a hard thing to understand. It's one, but it's full of variety. So how can you have all that variety, but it's all one? So we just say, well, that's because it's absolute. let's go on to the next point. Without really explaining necessarily what we mean by absolute. I think we kind of have a sense of it, even though we may not. That comes up a lot of times. You ask someone to define some word and they can't come up with another word for it. We all know what it means. We kind of know what it means to be absolute. So Krishna's goodness in absolute. So I would say it in this sense, in the sense that because he's God, he encompasses everything, there's no standard by which to judge him. Even if there are rules which he himself creates, then he doesn't have to follow those rules. They're his own rules. So here we're seeing that in the context of this material world, Krishna also creates rules, but those rules are relative. They're relative to the situation. This can sometimes muddy the waters a bit when you talk about goodness, because it seems pretty straightforward. What is the good? What is the right, the morally right thing to do? So is there always one morally right thing to do and a morally wrong thing to do in every situation? Doesn't seem to be the case. We find this even in the Mahabharata and other places where there are sometimes discussions. What's the right thing to do? And sometimes there are disagreements, and sometimes people can't quite figure it out, even very dharmic people. I was just editing an article by Chaitanya Charan, and he's talking about Draupadi when Dushasana attempted to disrobe her. So that whole scene in the Mahabharata. So when Draupadi she's in a dressing room actually, getting ready for some ceremony. She only has one cloth on because she hasn't put her sari on, her regal sari. So someone is sent in to get her because what has happened is she's been lost in the gambling match. You know, Yudhishthira lost everything, including his wife. First he lost himself and his brothers. Then he lost Draupadi. So the messenger comes and explains the situation to Draupadi. You have to come now. Your husband, Yudhishthira, has lost you in the gambling match. So she thinks, very intelligent, of course, Draupadi, says, well, ask him this question. Was Yudhishthira lost before he lost me? So they go into the assembly Even Bhishma is there. I'm not sure if this question, there's some follow-up, it's a little intricate, I don't remember all the details. But that's the basic idea. If Yudhishthira was a slave, then that means slaves are not allowed to own anything. So I wasn't his property, so how could he gamble me away? That's her question. But then there's another consideration, which I can't remember right now. There are two things to consider. I think the first one was that just she was his wife, even though he was a slave. Maybe that was it. But then slaves aren't allowed to own property. Something like that. There was this dilemma where there were two competing,
The other one was, if I'm not his property, then how can I gamble away? Because I'm not his property. Yes. So that was himself.
Right. In other words, if I were a slave, then...
No.
If Yudhishthira were a slave already, then I would also be a slave, right? So he couldn't get it, he couldn't...
Then I'm lost
already, so how could he gamble me?
Then it doesn't make any sense that he is giving me away because I already got lost.
Right.
But if I am not his property, so to speak, as a wife, I'm not his property, then if he lost himself, then... He has no right on me.
Because he's a slave, so he can't own property.
He cannot own me, and so he cannot give me away. So what is the problem? What is the truth here? In other words, either way, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah. That's why Bhishmadev was speechless. He couldn't say anything. Now, one brother of Duryodhana, Bikarna, he stood up for Draupadi. But then he was just dismissed, especially Karna. He argued, he just dismissed him. Don't listen to him, he's a fool. And he was explaining how this whole thing was a setup from the beginning, and Yudhishthira didn't want to gamble, but he was basically forced to do it, and so on. So anyway, in the Mahabharata, we get these kinds of, sometimes splitting of hairs of dharma, what is right and what is wrong. And if you read the Manusamhita, I read the Manusamhita about a year ago, and it seemed to be a pretty, now, many of these, some of these books, we have certain, some of our books where we feel are quite true to the original. For one thing, one reason that we understand that they're true to the original, because there's a commentarial tradition going back quite a long ways. So if Madhvacharya goes through a particular book and he quotes on, or he gives commentary on practically every verse, then we say, well, this must be reliably what this scripture was 1,000 years ago. So we, and it's basically the same now. So something like the Manusmriti, how much has it changed over the time? Sometimes it's hard to nail it down. So in academic circles, they have what they call like a definitive edition, something like that. Someone will look, a scholar will look at all the different manuscripts and try to reconcile the differences and come up with one that all scholars will accept. Okay, this is the one. So I read a Manusamhita that was based on one of those, which is full of footnotes and all kinds of citations and everything. Big academic book. But then this person wrote kind of a popular edition, you might say, of the Manusamhita. This scholar, I forget what his name was. So it seemed, you know, be a fairly reliable rendition of the Manusamhita. In fact, this scholar, in many places, he says, I think this is an interpolation. Interpolation means an addition. I think this was probably added by some translators or so, you know, over time, or copyists. You know, they had a tendency sometimes this would happen because you had scribes in the early days. So they would copy things. This, by the way, is this criticism is made of the Bible also. That people say, yeah, well, these scribes, they kind of added things here and there. They let me write my own commentary, slip it in between these two sayings here of Jesus, you know, expand it a little bit. So this scholar on Manusamhita, he clearly says in certain places, I think this whole section is an interpolation because it seems to be wrong. But some of the things, when you read the Manusamhita, you think, boy, this seems really strange. Some of these rules. What it got me thinking was, now we know, for example, that we might, in some sense, we dismiss the Manusamhita because we say, well, it's Kali Yuga. We can't follow Manusamhita. It's all about Varnashram, which doesn't exist, and so on. But still, according to our perception, the Manusamhita is coming from Krishna, or at least Manu is empowered by Krishna. And we would say that it's the laws for a perfect society. But there's a lot of hair splitting, it seems to be, in the Manusamhita. And for me, it's really hard to relate to, I think. This is how you'd run a perfect society? One of the things, for example, is called trial by fire. So this is how it works, basically. The accused person, to test whether the person is innocent or not. Now, this the person who translated this, he didn't say this was an interpolation, at least according to him. Now, he may be wrong, but at least according to him, this is in the original. So the trial by fire is to judge whether a person is innocent or guilty. You pace, I forget how many, a certain number of banyan leaves in the person's hand. I think it's like 6 of them or something. There's some specified number. And then you put hot burning coal on the top of those leaves. Then the person has to walk 100 yards or whatever it is, a certain distance. And then, you know, if he doesn't have any blisters on his hand when he gets to the other end, that means he's innocent. So supposedly, this is in the Manusamhita. Anyway, that's kind of an extreme case of, you say, wow, that's really God's law. That's God's law. That's how you judge if someone's innocent. But then there are other things. One thing about the Manusamhita, a lot of it has to do with, it starts with rules for brahmanas, then kshatriyas, then vaishyas, then shudras. So there are lots of rules for brahmanas. So brahmanas have to follow a lot of rules that the other classes don't have to follow. Especially the Shudras, they're given free rein to do a lot more things. Whereas Brahmins, they have to do everything just right. And if they deviate, there's pretty serious punishments for those things. So we have this idea that good is not only one thing. something may be considered good or morally right if you're a Brahmana, whereas if you're in one of the other castes, then you don't have to follow that rule. It's morally right for you to do something else. Just like it's morally right for Kshatriyas to take intoxication in certain circumstances. It's allowed. It's allowed for them to kill animals. Not only do they, one thing I found, that we often hear that they like capture animals and then kill them in sacrifice, but they also kill them just to become accustomed to killing, and they also kill them and then sacrifice them later. At least that seems to be the situation in the ninth canto. There's some situation like that where somebody killed some animal and brought it for sacrifice, and then the person to whom he brought it, I think it was Vasishtha, he says, wait a minute, I can tell that somebody's already, you know, partially eaten this. So how can I offer it in sacrifice? The person who killed it ate some of it. How can I offer it in sacrifice now? But anyway, there's all these intricate rules about what is good. So part of the whole point here is that Krishna is saying here, I've been explaining all of these things about good and bad or pious and impious, but really the bottom line is it's really hard to figure out always. There's not always a clear distinction. And not because of just the nature of things, but even because of what the Vedas say, what the Vedas themselves say about these things. So the implication, of course, is just chant Hare Krishna. That's the simple thing. Just chant Hare Krishna. Or you know, Krishna, of course, what Krishna is prescribing, as he has been throughout this whole Uddhava Gita, is devotional service to him. That's what he's encouraging Uddhava, and of course Uddhava is going to carry his message on to others. He's being deputed to do that. So, lucky for us, we don't have to worry about these things too much. Although I think to relate this to Krishna consciousness, this often occurs to me that we want to, at least ideally, do the best thing, don't we? I mean, we wish that we would always do the best thing, and we maybe feel a sense of guilt that I don't always do the best thing or the right thing or the Krishna conscious thing. In a certain situation, sometimes I wonder, well, I have some freedom of choice here. What is the most Krishna conscious thing to do now? Then I think, is there only one answer to that question? It seems to me there's not always one answer. Now, certain fanatical people may think, no, there's only one answer. Even what you should do with your life in Krishna consciousness, there's only one thing you should be doing, that everybody should be doing. But is that true? It doesn't seem to me that's true. It seems to me that devotees, we have certain freedom. We have certain freedom of choice on how to act in Krishna consciousness, how to serve Krishna. So there's not only one good or one ultimate good according to the definition in Krishna consciousness of devotional service. In other words, there are many ways to please Krishna. He doesn't accept only one kind of offering. He likes a whole meal with many varieties, sometimes unlimited varieties. You ever go to some Maha feast in Vrindavan and you see they prepare like 1,008 preparations, or you know, each one of them is different than the other. It's incredible. So Krishna likes variety. So we also have some variety of choice in how we serve Krishna. And what makes the offering acceptable, of course, is the bhava, it's the feeling, it's the desire to please Krishna. That's what makes it right. And of course, that ties into this whole idea of absolute goodness. What is absolutely good? Pleasing Krishna. That's what's absolutely good, no matter what that particular thing is. And it may change according to circumstances. Arjuna had to kill his relatives. That was absolutely good because Krishna was standing right there telling him to do it. So that's the measure. That's the measure of all things. And how we judge whether something is good, whether Krishna is pleased. That's how we judge what is pious and impious. All right, let me just read the translation here. Sometimes piety becomes sin, and sometimes what is ordinarily sin becomes piety on the strength of Vedic injunctions. Such special rules, in effect, eradicate the clear distinction between piety and sin. Okay, back there. Tiri Vikrama. Manasmita expert.
Very interesting. So, let us say within the, you know, because Lord Krishna was also within the Varnashram system, he, you know, he kind of relate with this system somewhat. There's general rule for all the Varnas and Ashram, but then there's exceptional rules. I mean, not all the Varnas and all the Ashram have to follow all the rules. There is some basic rules that all of them have to follow, like this, and so forth. But then there's exceptional rules. You see? So Lord Krishna is getting into that too. And, you know, like I said the other day, for example, a Brahmana, he's not supposed to have a dog, you know, because that would contaminate everything. But like a Sudra could, you know, he could have a dog running, or the different cats, you know. One class can kill, the Kshatriya can kill, but the Brahmanas is not allowed, or this, you know. And then sometimes there are even deeper rules than that. One time, Arjuna was going to kill Yudhishthira. And Krishna said, what are you doing? I don't see any enemy here. Why are you pulling out the sword? And he says, well, he made me break my vow. So Lord Krishna brought up this very point. There is exceptional to the rule. And sometimes you have to consider what is the higher good in this. This is your brother, he's the king. So you can't do it. But even if he made you break your vow, but the higher rule is that he's the king, so you can't do that. And then he relate a story and show that this sage of telling truth, he made all these people got killed innocently and so forth, you know. So there's exception to the rule, and, you know. That's how we see
it. A couple of
comments. I was always not really clear what absolute means for a long time. But what helped me was getting the Latin source, which is ab, prefix ab, and solvere. Solvere, from solvere we get solvent.
Means what?
In the sense of freeing. So an ab means away from. So in the sense that... the thing is freed from conditions, like you said, freed from conditions, from limitations, and applicable, therefore applicable in all circumstances forever, without ever having to change for anything. Hmm. Absolutely. Another comment.
It sounds like impersonalists would use that as, it's kind of like Brahman, so that's why they would say, well, that's a fact and it doesn't have any qualities. In fact, this is a criticism. This is one of the, in this Euthyphro dilemma, some people will say, well, if you're giving God, if God likes some things and doesn't, that means he has a particular limited personality or limited nature. He has his likes and dislikes, basically. He likes goodness or doesn't like certain things. So even what you're saying here, it sounds like that means a complete absence of any qualities.
Yeah, but you could... But Krishna is Vishesh, he's with, it's like saying Nirguna, Krishna is Nirguna, he doesn't have material qualities. That's how I would see that. He's freed from material restrictions. That doesn't limit you know, individuality and spirit, or negate it necessarily. And another comment, talking about Socrates, there was a German professor who was teaching in a new Mayapur Gurukul in the 80s, he told me the story that when Socrates took hemlock, his disciple Plato was so disgusted with society and the status quo that he went traveling. He left, and he came in touch with some followers of Pythagoras, who and he was so impressed by the knowledge that they had, he asked them where Pythagoras got his knowledge from. They told him that he was instructed by some gymnosophoi, people called gymnosophoi. Gymno means half naked, osophoi means philosophers, who carried staffs, and they came from the east. Pythagoras actually visited. There's a lot. Yeah. Pythagoras. Yeah, I know. He went to India. But another comment I wanted to make was, I think that, you know, we're talking about relativity and absoluteness, and I think that Einstein, with his theory of relativity, he was really an ambassador for Mayavad and materialism, because he says that a motion or a force can only be understood within an inertial system, meaning that with reference to, you know, a previously agreed set of coordinates. So basically what that means is that nothing is real. You know, everything only has validity when it relates to something else on a pre-agreed system. So that's my advice, you know, everything is illusion. I think that's I think he was a tool in the hands of Shankaracharya.
Yeah, that's where philosophical speculation gets you, actually, or even scientific speculation. It gets you to impersonalism, ultimately. It doesn't get you to the person, Krishna, because he's beyond that. Because it makes sense. I mean, you know, everything is, it's like scientists have discovered, well, everything is one, even if you look at molecules and atoms and some atomic particles, that's all there is. So it's all one thing, basically. This variety that we see is just kind of an illusion. So that's where their speculation gets them, actually. They're not going to see Krishna in that way. That tends to be what happens to these very smart people. They end up in personalism.
So the absolute good, the ultimate good is pleasing Krishna. So the big question, of course, is how do we know whether we're pleasing Krishna? I mean, there's some elementary answers to that, but, you know, you were saying how there's a lot of latitude that devotees are given by Krishna and how to please him. So that's somewhat of a dilemma for devotees, is to figure out, well, what do I do? You know,
sometimes you just have to make a decision. You pray to Krishna, you seek advice, and then at some point you make a decision. And as I was saying, there may not only be one answer. Krishna may be pleased if you do this or the other thing. If your intention is to please him, as long as it's not just something completely wacky, and if you're getting advice from others and you're consulting the scripture and Krishna within the heart, then you make your educated decision, informed choice as much as possible. So it comes down to you in one sense. We're being trained to use our intelligence to make that kind of decision. Was that Mohan Prabhu?
A couple of comments. One, there was a nice verse in 1:17:16 Bhagavatam. It says, the supreme duty of the ruling king is to give all protection to law-abiding citizens, persons, and to chastise those who stray from the ordinance of the scriptures in ordinary times when there's no emergency. So, like what you're reading there, there's the rule and then there's an emergency. The house is on fire. That's an emergency by which you can just, you know, break the roof and it's not considered. So it seems like a little bit of common sense. You know, this is the general understanding, but there's exceptions that you have to understand. Just like one time Sesha was giving class about, is it always correct to not lie? And then he gave the example of somebody who was hiding a murderer, and he told the murderers, ask him, he says, don't tell him I'm here.
Yeah. You know. No, I think this kind of thing, which of course I also talked about in class, kind of muddies the waters in the discussion of this youth referral dilemma. That's not what they're talking about. Oh. They're talking about there are certain things that are, you know, everybody will accept that it's bad. And we're not talking about, you know, this situation or that situation. Certain things that everybody will agree that they're bad. But why are they bad? I mean, this is something I've often thought about, for example, with evolution. How do you explain this basic conscience, you might say, that human beings have. Most human beings have the sense that, well, you shouldn't just torture a child, for example. Well, every human being is going to say, that's just wrong. Why is it wrong? Well, I think our answer is because God is good, and everything springs from that, and we are as sparks of God. We have this innate understanding within us that that's just wrong. But to try to, you know, we came from apes, and somewhere along the way, we got this sense, because in the animal kingdom, I think there are animals who even eat their own young. This kind of thing happens in the animal world. So, of course, we would think, well, you know, kill and eat your own child. Of course, there are demented people who do these kinds of things. But most people think, well, of course, that's the most horrible thing in, you know, imaginable. So that's the kind of thing that they're, this dilemma is about, you know. Kind of like, why, where did that come from, that this is bad? Is it bad just because God says it's bad? But we have a sense. We have a sense that it's bad. Now, by the way, this dilemma that I was talking about, the atheist likes to use it as, see, you can't explain, so there is no God, there is no absolute goodness, so we can just make it up as we go along. Whatever we want to make good, we'll just make good. And that's changing as we evolve. Certain things, and of course we see that in society, things that were unthinkable before are becoming commonplace today. Things that were considered bad, now they're considered good as society degrades. But we say, well, that's because people are getting more and farther away from their conscience, their innate God consciousness is being obliterated by the times and the situations we're living in.
Yeah. Sometimes Prabhupada would define absolute as it stays the same in past, present, and future, where relative is according to time, place, and circumstance.
Yeah, so that's one relativity is time. So it transcends that particular relativity among all the others.
And one thought about those banyan leaves or walking with that. Uh-huh. And nowadays they have a thing called galvanic skin response, which is a lie detector test.
Oh.
And they, your skin changes with honesty and dishonesty.
Yeah.
And they can measure that because there's a different it conducts differently. So you burn easier when you're wet.
Well, that's interesting.
So that
I never thought of that. There may be a psychological reason for why it works. The banyan leaf trial by fire. Maybe it's not as absurd as I thought it was.
There's things, I mean, we're in technology time, but I mean, the same principles that you actually...
Yeah, if the guy's lying, he's going to get burned. If he's not, he's not going to get burned. Interesting.
And one other little thing.
We'll experiment with it sometime.
The Nitya Siddha Krishna praying that we are hardwired a particular way, being part and parcel of Krishna. We're just covered. But underneath it all, there's certain things that we call conscience. It comes through.
I was wondering, we're talking about, we use the word absolute, yeah? And we don't really understand, or we do, or partially. One statement that we make that I have a hard time to understand, and maybe you could explain, is all contradictions lie... are solved in
all contradictions are resolved in Krishna. That
yeah,
idea.
What does that mean?
It's what's the word? It's translogical. Well, Prabhupada did give some examples. For example, Krishna is, well, because he's God, he's unlimited, but he's also within everything. So there's one contradiction. How can God be everything and also be within everything? Well, he can, but it's beyond logic. I mean, how is that possible? According to ordinary logic, that's not possible. So that's one example. There may be other things, too. I don't know, I can't... No examples is coming right to my mind. But it seems to be that that's the idea. That because he's God, he encompasses everything. And also, of course, we tend to think of it as... Well, it doesn't work. I'll say one thing, it isn't. It's not that God can make a square circle. This kind of thing comes up sometimes with people. They want to challenge, well, God can do anything. Can God make a square circle? You say, no, that's just logically impossible. So that's not what we're talking about here. So I don't think that's what we're talking about here either in that sense. Of course, I may have just given an example of something that seems logically impossible. So there is that sense that because we're talking about God, there are things that are achintya. Achintya means inconceivable. Or, yeah, what does it mean, really? Conceivable. Even that word is a tricky one. There are many things you can conceive that aren't really possible. So that's a tricky word. So this idea that everything is reconciled in Krishna, I guess I'd have to see the context where that's put. I mean, I think sometimes we use it in the wrong way. We say things that are clearly contradictory philosophically, and you might say they don't even fit Krishna. We might say, well, Krishna, anything is possible. Now, one thing Jiva Goswami does say, which I came across in his commentary in the Bhagavad Sandarbha, he says that Krishna's achintya shakti means that he can do the impossible.
Hare Krishna. Oh, the visitors lost their bag with the passports.
What's happening here? Oh, I just came to get something. Somebody left behind.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, 25 miles away.
Oh. So get it to them immediately. That will be inconceivable. So I don't know. I don't think I have a good answer to that, what it means. Anybody can contribute something to this? What does it mean that Krishna reconciles opposites, basically?
Nothing that's impossible for Krishna to do or to solve or whatever. I mean, we see even like within the whole...
Yeah, but to reconcile opposites would be something like Krishna is always loving. Krishna hates. So how would you reconcile those two?
Oh, Krishna...
Those are opposites.
Yeah,
Krishna is always loving, but Krishna hates somebody.
Well, he himself...
Can you reconcile that? But can he be all loving and all hating at the same time? That's what it sounds like we're saying, right?
But he didn't really hate Shishupala. I mean, that point came up in Yudhishthira. You know, he's absolute. So in Shishupala's case, because Shishupala margined to him even though he killed him. He margined him, so Yudhishthira was surprised.
I'm not talking about actions. I'm talking about feelings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can Krishna love everyone and hate everyone at the same time?
But Krishna...
That's what we're talking about.
If he wants, Krishna can reconcile irreconcilable
differences.
No, we can say if he wants, he can do it. But he doesn't. He doesn't do that for you. But if he wants, he can do it. I mean, in other words, not.
Well, that's a big question, actually. Can God do this? Also comes up in this discussion. If you say that this is God's nature, then you say that something else is not His nature. Can He change His nature? Did God have a choice about what His nature is, or is it just God's nature, and it was eternally?
This is the kind of things
that philosophers at philosophy of religion gets into, which we don't really talk about these things. We don't do this kind of philosophical speculation about God exactly.
Well, sometimes He might not do it in His form, but He might get a different incarnation to do the contradictory thing and stuff, you know, like that.
Yeah, these debates are really limited to philosophers. These debates, in one sense, are limited to the philosophers.
This is what philosophers do. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're restricted to the mental and intellectual platform. So within the mental and intellectual sphere of negotiating whatever the stuff is, that's really as far as you can go. One argument constantly has the potential to trump another argument, and there's no conclusion because you're all within the relative bubble.
Yeah.
You know, so Krishna, round, square, I mean, we're defining what's round, we're defining what's square, how can it be two definitions at once? This is all our problem, you know? this is really a one-level problem. It's not like necessarily Krishna's problem.
Yeah, this is a good illustration of the limits of philosophical speculation. It shows clearly what you get stuck. Well done.
It always concludes to me that rasa trumps tattva. That ultimately, everything it's all part of rasa, and as it's rendered to me, Krishna reciprocates as far as the mental capacity, the different understandings that everyone in the human form or the demigod form or in the material universe understands is being allowed to under one of Krishna's energies, either the internal potency or the external potency, and it's part of the connection with Krishna.
I probably would sometimes say, don't try to understand Krishna, just to love Krishna. To love Krishna.
He reserves the right to not be.
Because there are things, because he's God, you don't understand him in that way, intellectually, ultimately. So, even Jiva Goswami doesn't deal with these things. Of course, he does get into philosophical arguments, but he's dealing with a different kind of philosophical opponents, like Mayavadis especially. So he has arguments tailored for them. He's not dealing with arguments that have come up, you know, in Western philosophy. So a lot of these things, we don't actually address them, not address them. Although Prabhupada does touch on them sometimes in his purports. But we don't put a lot of effort into all this brain-twisting stuff that they get into. All right, let's stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.